Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com. Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Aki Katema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine and America. And it's April 6th, and I hope everybody's staying safe and in good spirits as well. So we normally broadcast live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, but our studio is currently closed due to the outbreak of COVID-19 caused by coronavirus, as everybody knows. So we are recording this episode remotely from my Brooklyn apartment, and so is my guest. And it may sound a little different than usual, but please bear with us. So this show is all about Japanese food and food culture. That's why it's called Japan Eats. And we see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what if we own sushi? We hear dashi and ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is so mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Shinobu Kato, who is the owner and brewer of Kato Sake Works in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Shinobu soft opened his sake brewery just a few weeks ago, right before everything got started due to coronavirus. And he was dreaming about and carefully planning this new sake brewery while he was working as IT project manager at a major corporation in the US. As you may know, New York City already has a first sake brewery called Brooklyn Kura in Industry City, Brooklyn, which opened in 2017. The owners Brian Pollan and Brandon Dawn joined us twice to discuss the experience of opening and managing the craft sake brewery outside Japan. Now here's Shinobu, who is born and raised in Japan, making sake with his own philosophy of brewing sake. So today we'll discuss how Shinobu got into sake, his life philosophy, which is interesting, that prompted him to a new career, and his authentic yet very local style of sake, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any comments or requests for short topics or guests, please let us know. You can email us at japaneats@theheritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Now let's start a conversation with Shinobu Kato. Hello, Shinobu. Welcome.
Hello, Akiko-san. Thank you very much for having me.
So this is really exciting.
Yeah.
So a couple of weeks ago, we met at your brewery, not knowing what's going to happen. But yeah, your sake was amazing. So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So let's talk about who you are. So where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
All right. So I was born and grew up in Tokyo, a small neighborhood called Koenji. So that's a small town, probably like 10 minutes train ride from the city center of Tokyo. So mm-hmm. kind of same proximity of Bushwick to, Manhattan. And it's a very residential and a commercial mixture of both. But there's no big businesses, but more like a small restaurants, bars, and shops. And it has like a hippie culture. So people feel like it was like a time travel 20 years ago in Tokyo, kind of a spa. And, there's a lot of ramen shops and yakitori, izakaya, something like that. What I grew up to eat, I was raised by my grandparents, and then they loved junk food. So my grandpa hated fish, and he loved, fried food, tonkatsu, and ramen, and gyoza. And my grandpa didn't like to cook, so every time me and my grandma were together, she was like, hey, Shinobu, do you want to have McDonald's? Do you want to go to KFC? Do you want to have instant noodles? Or, hey, Domino pizzas? So that's how I grew up with. Well, my parents were completely different, and then they used to own a small izakaya. And my dad, when I was small kid, used to take me to a Tsukiji market every I don't remember which day, but every, you know, every week, and then did a fish shopping. My mom never ate junk food, and she, you know, she still, I have not never seen her eating McDonald's or KFC. So I kind of did a, you know, combination of both sides.
Right. So, yeah, it sounds like I really asked this question because it really shows who you are based on what you ate, and you're a really great mixture of, you know, Japan and America. So it's already started when you grew up. Yeah, I didn't know that your parents had izakaya, so that's interesting.
Yes.
So, and you came to the States in 2004 to attend business school, but what did you do before you came to the States?
So I went to the college, you know, typical college for partying, you know, had a bunch of cheap sake, you know, quantity over quality, you know, college school life. And then I worked at a company called SoftBank. I think now it's kind of famous in the U.S. thanks to like WeWork investment and a Splint takeover, those kind of things. But at the time, it was just a small internet venture company. And I was just working as a typical Japanese salaryman. So, you know, wearing a suit, commute in a pack train, and 9 a.m. to midnight type of work. So that was what I was doing.
Mm. Well, SoftBank is huge. You made it modest, but it's a big deal. So
right now, yes, but at that time, no.
Right. And I heard that it was your boss in Japan when you were at SoftBank who inspired you to get into sake. So can you tell us about that?
Yes. So, you know, before joining the company, you know, college drinking was, you know, you drink whatever available cheapest. And I think the same is true in the U.S., right? Like, you guys had a cheap, bad beers here. You know, I heard the beer called, you know, a lot of bad beers. But we did the same thing in college. I drank a lot of, you know, cheapest sake available in the market. Once I start working in the company, you know, Japanese work culture is very different. So people work together from, you know, morning till the midnight, but go out for drinks and then, you know, dinner on almost every day together, right? Mm. And also with the seniority system, usually it's the boss who pays the bill. And I never touch the bill. Well, I pretend to pay, but that never happened. So he was like my mentor, something like that. And he knew that I had a horrible, you know, palate for sake. And we started going out. And one time, we go to a nice, fancy izakaya in Roppongi, or, you know, near Roppongi. It's much quieter side of Roppongi. And they have a great, you know, sushi and another other nice upscale izakaya menu with a very great sake menus. And by the time I was kind of exposed to a better craft sake, thanks to my boss, but the sake that he ordered for me at the time was from the brewery called the Kokuryu. It's a brewery in Fukui, a 200 years old brewery, and they had a limited edition called Daiginjo Shizuku. So Shizuku is like a droplet, and now I know what that is, but it's a gently pressed without pressure, very fancy Daiginjo. And that kind of struck me like, oh, it's completely different. I never had a really good sake, and I like sake, you know? So that was a kind of, you know, life-changing moment to me. And then after that, I continued, you know, exploring more sake. So, you know, during the college time, it was a quantity over quality. After that incident, it became more like quantity and quality.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. That's interesting. Everyone has, in the sake business, it's not unusual to hear, you know, the glass of sake. Like, for example, yes. Tim Sullivan, who came to the show, and he's a brand ambassador for Hakkaisan, and his first sake was Hakkaisan sake. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, listeners, everybody, whoever gets to drink some nice special sake, you should try to remember. That might change your life. So, so you worked for such a great company with a wonderful boss. So, but you decided to leave that nice job and came to the States in 2004 to attend business school. So why did you do that?
Well, I enjoyed my job. It was, you know, hardworking job, but at the same time, quite rewarding. And my boss was nice, of course. And I had a great food and the sake in Tokyo. So it was quite comfortable, but probably I felt a little bit too comfortable, maybe. You know, when you've been in the comfortable zone for a long time, the life becomes more like autopilot. And you don't have to be on the driver's seat, but, you know, the life will take you to the wherever the destination that the road, you know, leads to, right? And I was like, okay, maybe I need a little more challenge. And I knew that, you know, my work and my life was more kind of confined in Tokyo and Japan. And I knew that there's a bunch of things outside of that small, comfortable world of Tokyo. So I think that's the reason that I decided to leave the country. Yeah.
Well, I think the majority of us never think there's no too comfortable place. So, yeah, it's amazing how much you're aware of who you are. And, well, here's my favorite quote. So, well, listeners, Shinoba's amazing website. It's a personal website that really describes his journey up to this point. It's called shinobukato.com. And he quotes on his website from a left by the Brazilian writer, Paulo Coelho. Sorry, my Portuguese is bad. And to live is to experience things, not sit around pondering the meaning of life. That is really, you walk the talk, amazing.
You know, somebody told me that I have to do some self-branding, and then I set up the website, and then I kind of, you know, it's a bit embarrassing, but yeah.
Yeah, I usually never go through somebody's website that I did with yours, so thoroughly, but I think it's really worth going through. It's really, yeah, I was so touched many times.
Okay.
Yeah, so after you graduated from, so you went to the Robert M. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland and earned an MBA. And you worked for Nissan Corporation in Nashville, Tennessee, as product manager in the IT department. And I heard that that was when you started making sake. So how did it happen?
So in Nashville, or again, it was quite a comfortable life in Nashville with a, you know, big house, big backyard, something like that. And me and my wife started throwing parties to my, you know, local friend in Nashville. Oh, so we love cooking. So we cooked some Japanese food, not like sushi or, you know, those fancy stuff, but more like a day-to-day Japanese otsumami type of thing, and invited dozens of our friends to the parties. The problem that we had was there was no sake to pair with at the parties. So, you know, I didn't want to go back to my college drink sake. Right? I've already graduated from that. But at the same time, it's hard for me to find a kokuryu in Nashville. Or, you know, just to be fair, there were a couple of good liquor stores in Nashville, and then they carried a nice sake that I like, but they are like three times overpriced, and I didn't have that big budget for the party, right? So, and you know, you can tell all my friends are drinkers, so they drink a lot. So I ended up having like a small keg of IPA from the local brewery, or like, you know, get a, you know, box of wine, you know, dozens of wine from the local winery, something like that. And I felt ashamed. You know, the same thing happened when I go to a, like a local sushi restaurant that, you know, they have a decent sushi available in Nashville. There are a couple of places that I used to go, but their sake menu is either the no brand, you know, hot sake, 2-for-1 happy hour hot sake, or something a little too expensive than the actual value. And we ended up drinking like a glass of Chardonnay. And always like, it's a shame, right? So, and then at that time, I had a couple of friends who started home brewing beer. And also, I frequented craft breweries, local breweries in the area, and started talking with the brewers there. So, you know, making beer becomes more kind of close to me. And then I was thinking about it. Maybe I should start brewing something. What should I brew? Oh, yeah, sake, because there's no sake available. So that's how I started brewing. I never thought I'd start my own brewery, but that's how I started 2 seconds ago.
So out of necessity, that always works, yeah. Right? For something good.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I know many people who try to make sake or something, you know, beer or kombucha or anything. But what made you to decide that you would leave another good corporate job at Nissan and start your own sake brewery in the U.S.?
So probably the same reason that I decided to come to the U.S. But, you know, after I was with Nissan for close to 10 years, and it was an interesting job. I had a, you know, team of software engineers, you know, on site, offshore, you know, or implementing the software solutions here and there. So it was kind of interesting. But at some point, it became a little too comfortable to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the life became autopilot again. Mm-hmm. And I needed the challenge. And then, you know, if I go back 10 years ago, I didn't come to the U.S. to find another comfortable life here. So what I'm doing was my question. The challenge I had was, as a foreigner, it's hard for me to do something because of my visa status, right? Mm-hmm. You need to have a sponsor, like a corporate sponsor to, you know, sponsor your immigration status. And it took long time for me to get the green card. But without a green card, you cannot even, you know, quit the company. Well, it's possible, but it's hard, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But I got a green card. And then also at the same time, my wife got a job offer in Tokyo. And she was like, oh, this is my dream job. So I should go to Tokyo for this job, whatever, you know, I support you, whatever you do, but this is my dream job. So I should go to Tokyo. And, so, you know, I was like, okay, I'm Nashville, Tennessee, but I'm kind of done with my corporate life there. What should I do? Oh, by the way, there's a problem with all the sake shortage or whatever the sake that I cannot serve at the party. I know how to make sake. Can I make that as a real solution, like economical solution for as a business? So that's how I kind of started more serious.
Right. And I also heard that one of your friends wanted to buy your sake. That's when you got convinced that you can make it into a real business.
Yes. So her name was Sarah, and she is a good friend of mine. But she never had a good sake. She had a sake. So like she was like a typical average American consumer that when you go to a sushi restaurant, you order house sake, hot sake, the one in a white calyx with, you know, piping hot, loving alcohol kind of sake. And she confessed to me that, hey, I never liked sake. Although, you know, every time I go to sushi restaurant, I order sake, but I never liked it. And when she had my sake, she told me that, hey, this is the first time I like sake and I enjoy drinking sake. I want to drink more sake. Oh, wow. Can I buy your sake? I want to bring your bottle to my family's Thanksgiving dinner and then give that to my parents and then grandparents.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So that was the kind of moment that I started thinking, okay, yeah. This has been my problem, but maybe this can solve other people's problem at the same time. You know?
Right. So you gave her your kokuryu moment to her.
Yeah.
So
I mean, yeah, I don't want to compare my sake with kokuryu, but yes.
Yeah, I think to her that was kokuryu. So, and then you moved to New York to open a sake brewery 3 years ago, I think. And
yes.
So, why did you choose New York?
So at that time, there was no sake breweries in New York. You know, Brooklyn Club was not here yet. And I was simple to think that, okay, where should I go? Oh, okay, what city has the most potential? Oh, New York is the biggest city in the US, and there's no sake breweries. Can I do this in New York? You know, if I can try in the biggest city in the US and it works, that's great. If it's not, at least I failed the biggest, right?
Right.
So that was, you know, that was probably the biggest reason.
Right, because so many restaurants and many Japanese restaurants and their premium sake sold, so people are really pretty well educated about sake too, so you don't have to try to find more, you know, sophisticated customers already, right? It's because market is more mature compared to places like Nashville, although I heard Nashville is really changing on a daily basis right now.
Yes, that's true. And then it's kind of funny, but on the day that I moved from Nashville to New York, I was driving, and my friend texted me that, hey, Shinobu, have you seen this article? And then this was an article about Nashville's first sake brewery opening in next month.
Wow.
Yeah, so Nashville was changing too, yeah.
Right. But you really captured the right timing, I guess. And in a way, you know, you were the second sake brewery opened, but Brooklyn Kura probably showed already, paved the way for you to succeed, because the pie is already big and you can add in, you can add the pie bigger, you know, the more like size of it.
Yeah, I fully agree that I, you know, thanks to Brooklyn Kura, I don't know how many hours I saved by not answering the same question that probably they've been answering all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and then now you have a very compact, it's efficient and a cool sake brewery, Bushwick, Brooklyn, right around the corner of a studio normally. So why did you choose Bushwick for your brewery location?
When I moved to New York, I decided that, okay, New York is too big, so let's, you know, focus on one area. And then I picked Brooklyn. The reason being, Brooklyn, I thought that Brooklyn has a more like a local, loyal culture. And that's similar to what I had in Nashville, but people love made in local. So people loved made in Nashville. And, you know, my sake was accepted in Nashville because it's made in local. And then I wanted to have a kind of similar culture. And then I picked Brooklyn. Oh, Brooklyn's too big for me, so I kind of Airbnb'd different neighborhood for a week. So stayed in Sunset Park, Greenpoint, you know, or Bushwick. And the first time I got off the subway at the Morgan Street station, right next to Roberta's, I was like, okay, this is a place. Somehow, I love this neighborhood. And this neighborhood, Bushwick, reminded me very much of my hometown, Koenji, in Tokyo. So it's like, you know, the cross-section of very traditional residential old neighborhood and today's hip and art kind of combined together. And, you know, there's a lot of like cheap dive bars. And then also there's a lot of, you know, breweries, something like that. And I really liked this neighborhood on the first sight. And it was confirmed that 2 years ago, my mom came over, visited me, and she told me the same thing, that, oh, this reminds me of her hometown, Koenji.
Wow. So,
yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Bushwick is pretty unique. And it's also a mixture of industrial, actually their warehouses and factories, so I can see them. And it's very interesting, very cool, very artistic. And there are so many artists actually live there still. But at the same time, Koenji, it's one of the coolest up and coming towns, right, in Tokyo. So Nishiogikubo, Koenji, and those places on the Chuo line, it's becoming really cool too. So in that sense, it's the same. Yeah. Bushwick and Koenji are both up and coming.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm a very local person. And then whenever I go back to Tokyo, I don't leave Koenji. I don't even take a subway. You know, I stayed in the, my hometown and I just go to the different izakayas in the neighborhood. And then now here in Bushwick, I do the same thing, that I don't take subway often and I just stay in the neighborhood.
Right. Oh, that's so cool. All right. And so, well, now let's talk about, you know, about your brewery itself. So what challenges did you come across before opening the brewery a couple of weeks ago? I mean, you're still in the process of soft opening, but, you know, I mean, I would have no idea how to open a sake brewery. It's not just a brewery, but sake brewery in the middle of Bushwick. So, so first of all, I heard that there was very hard to get licenses. So yes. How so?
So it is not that hard in terms of the paperwork. Paperwork is tedious, but it's straightforward. The challenge is the timing and the process. So in order for you to apply for the alcohol manufacturing license, first, you need to have a lease in place. You need to have a location because license is attached to the location and also the design of the brewery. So you need to have a lease in place. That means you have to start paying the rent, right? But license allows you to start producing alcohol. So you cannot do anything until you get the license. So there's a gap between when you apply for the license and until you get the license approved. And in our case, it took 8 months.
Right.
So yeah, during the 8 months, I was not able to make anything apart from, you know, continue building out the space but no revenue, nothing. And also the challenging part is you never know how long it takes because it's like, you know, waiting for your green card kind of situation that, you know, first come, first served, but first come, first served means when you applied, right? So now, you know, and historical average tells you that it's probably take 6 months. It's probably take 10 months, but nobody knows until you actually get the license. So you cannot plan ahead either. That people ask me, you know, while I was waiting for the license, hey, when is your opening day? When will we be ready? And then I was like, okay, I'd love to know that. I'd love to have that answer so that I can plan ahead. But
that's crazy.
Yeah.
So 8 months and you, wait, go ahead. Yeah, it's just 8 months still keep paying rent. I don't know how many $1,000 you have been paying, but it's crazy because you even don't know you can get licenses, right?
Yeah.
So, so, well, congratulations on that 8 months. It could have been worse.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Yeah, and I knew that my fellow breweries in New York, they went through the exact same process. And I knew somebody from the brewery, you know, owned by a big company. And then they also have to wait 8 months. So my friend told me that if they cannot bribe the state liquor authority or do anything, then there's no chance that I can get anything faster. So don't worry, you are not the exception. So that's good.
Right. Wow. And I also heard that, for sake brewery, sake is, in terms of licensing, sake is both categorized as wine and beer, right?
Yes.
So maybe you can explain.
Yeah, sake, well, there are two types of licenses. One is federal and the other is state. So under the federal license, sake is considered as a beer to make and wine to sell. So we have to have two different licenses for that. And according to the New York state, sake is wine. So both to produce sake and to sell sake, I need to have a winery license. Well, that was different when I was in Tennessee, Nashville, Tennessee. They consider sake as beer, so I needed to have a brewery license. So it's, you know, it's all over the place.
Wow. So you had to take two separate licenses from the state and the federal. So, and I'm sure that comes, they're issued at different times. I don't know which were issued first, federal or state?
Well, we get the federal first and then state later. Yeah. Mm, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, the sake probably would never have independent category and in wonder, you know, under one kind of rule. So if you apply for sake brewery, that could have been much, much simpler. But
yeah,
now, whoever wants to start a sake brewery here, they have to go through two separate.
You know, the same was true for the ciderlies long time. And finally, ciderlies get their own category. And that gives them a little bit of the freedom to do whatever they want to do. So I think, you know, it's just a matter of time that eventually people will give up and, hey, yeah, sake is a thing. So we need to handle sake as its own way. Probably.
Right. Well, I think the reason that the cideries got the special categories that it's going to contribute the local agriculture, right? So the governments, local governments realize that sake requires a lot of rice. And if they're grown locally, that could be a special, you know, source of income. So
yeah, the problem is New York does not grow rice, so maybe.
Well, it's global warming, but we'll see.
Yeah.
I mean, in Japan, all over the, you know, unless it's in Kyushu, rice grows so well.
That's true.
Yeah, so. Anyways, so that's another show we can have and discuss the agricultural production, sake rice. So how do you set up your production equipment without regular sake equipment manufacturers? Because in Japan, it's kind of like standard setup,
yes.
Right? But you don't have any.
Yes. So I was lucky to be introduced to one stainless steel manufacturer called Agile Stainless, located in Portland, Oregon. Somehow through my network, I got introduced to them, and then they were very much willing to help me to prototype a specific equipment for sake making. So they were willing to learn how sake process work, and then, you know, we brainstormed together to how to design the equipment from the scratch. And that stainless steel manufacturer has a great customer base in Brooklyn. So breweries like Glim and Highball, they use the equipment from that company. And also like a New York natto company, Nurture. And then also the new Macaulay Brewery in Greenpoint, Hana Macaulay, they also get the same equipment from the same company.
Mm, wow. What's the name of the company?
Agile Stainless.
Okay, Agile Stainless. So listeners, if you're planning to open a sake brewery, may be a good place.
Yeah, I visited their factory in Portland, Oregon, and it was really interesting. Like a cool hipster kind of stainless steel manufacturers. It was interesting.
Right, because Oregon has so many craft breweries, so that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. The challenge
I had was to learn the process engineering aspect of the brewing. So I myself never been an engineer, especially on the physical side. But in order for me to talk, you know, intelligently with a manufacturer, at least I need to have a base understanding of the principles and then concept. So I had to learn the, you know, process and the mechanical engineering things by myself. And then I enjoyed that, but it was kind of tough.
Right. So thanks to Nissan, you didn't expect you could use that knowledge and experience about, I think, the operation management in the
production.
Production. Right. Yeah. Okay, and also you never had a formal training in brewing sake, so how do you deal with like technical questions in the absence of brewmaster to learn from?
So my approach is similar to how I worked with a stainless steel manufacturer, but I just go back to the basic principle and then force myself to learn the basic first. And then understand the concept and the underlying principles. So like, you know, chemistry or biochemistry for the sake making itself. And, you know, to design the brewery, you at least need to understand the physics and the mechanical, you know, engineering portion. And to actually build a place, you need to know, you know, carpentry, plumbing, electrical work, those kind of thing. And every time I come up with some new question, I normally go back to like a high school textbook and refresh my memory. Okay, well, what's that? Yeah, up to the point that at least I understand what that means. And then, of course, the good thing about sake making is, you know, in Japan, sake industry is heavily regulated by the central government. The central government plays a fairly, you know, big role in the industry. The flip side, is all the researches or like academic papers are available to public because it's a government work. So if I, you know, Google any technical question about sake making, I usually go find at least one or two research papers talking about that in very technical way. And again, you know, having a document available and being able to understand the document is different things. I need to learn more to understand the document, but at least there's a reference available and I can go in and learn from that. The catch is everything is in Japanese, right? That's a challenge, but at least, you know, so far all the questions that I have in my process, there is no, probably one of two cases that I didn't find any research papers about that. But, you know, sake industry has been there for like 1,000 years. So there's a collective knowledge available.
And like you said, you know, the Japanese government shares not just information and research papers and the stuff, but also they are open to share, you know, the yeast, certain types for yeast, and you can buy nationwide. Yes. That's what I heard.
Yes.
Right? So
there's
no secret in a way.
And then, and then also the community is very supportive. So it's like a big family. So, you know, I met many sake brewers in Japan, and they are like really, you know, helpful. And they think I'm crazy doing sake making here in Brooklyn. But at the same time, they are really, you know, helpful. So if I have any like a specific question, they can, you know, run a test or do something, and then that's really good. Local beer and another like alcohol making community in Brooklyn is also great, supportive. So, you know, if I have any fermentation related questions, I can talk to any breweries in the neighborhood, and then they are ready to help. So far I've been very much, you know, I really appreciate this community support in Japan and also in Brooklyn.
Right. Well, it sounds like you're making sake, which by itself is a good experience, but you're also experiencing life through communicating with people and get to know the great people and building a new community. So, yeah, that's awesome. All right. So let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about Shinobu's unique sake. So please stay with us. Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com. Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese Podcast Live from Studio not the studio today, in my apartment in Bushwick, in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Shinobu Kato, who is the owner and brewer of the brand new and second sake brewery in New York City called Kato Sake Works in Bushwick, Brooklyn. So we've been talking about how you set up your brewery, but now let's talk about your sake itself, which I tasted and I found amazing. So first of all, you use Kalos rice for your sake. And Kalos is a eating rice and not a classic rice used to make sake. So why did you choose Kalos rice?
Okay, so I go a little bit technical here, but Kalos is one of the most popular medium grain rice varieties available in the US born in California in the middle of 1900s or something like that, before the war, after the war, something like that. And then as Akiko-san, you mentioned, it's not the sake rice, it's a table rice or a cooking rice. But the ancestor of this Kalos rice roots back to the now famous, now popular sake rice called omachi. So omachi is quite popular now, and then you can find a lot of great sake made with omachi rice. But this is the ancestor of Kalos. And during the first wave of the Japanese immigration to the United States, people brought rice from Japan, and then that's like a selected variety of omachi called wataribune. Mm-hmm. And then that rice is a short grain rice and hard to grow in the climate of California. At the same time, U.S. was trying to increase the production of rice in the United States. And there was a couple of different regions like Louisiana, Carolinas, and California that they tried to grow more rice. Somebody found the rice in Louisiana called the Lady Rice. And that's a long grain, like a typical native rice in Louisiana. And that long grain rice from Louisiana and the short grain rice from Japan, wataribune, are crossbred. And here we have Kalos. And by the way, this omachi to wataribune went to another famous sake rice called Yamada Nishiki. So Yamada Nishiki and Kalos are kind of somewhere closely related.
Right.
And yeah.
And it's Yamada Nishiki is a super premium, the most premium sake rice. So
Yeah.
There's a potential in Kalos rice.
Yeah. Well, when it comes to the sake making, Kalos is not as great as Yamada Nishiki. So there's a lot of, challenges that I have to make a good sake from Kalos. But I like the story of this, rice or history of this, Japanese immigrating them to the U.S. with, handful of rice. And then I think they had some dream in the U.S. and then they also had challenges during the war, something like that. And then also on the American side, there are people who tried to, include and welcome this immigration from the, one of the small Asian countries. And voila, we have a hybrid called Kalos that is so popular in the United States. And without having a Kalos, I don't think we have a California roll at the corner deli in nowadays, right? And if I can make a sake, like a casual sake using the same rice and make that sake, as accessible as spicy tuna roll or California roll, I think that's something. So I really want to focus using this Kalos rice.
Right. Yeah. And I heard it actually Kalos accounts for 90% of California's total rice production by quantity. So that's like America, very American.
Yes.
And but I'm also curious about, you use the water from New York and it's known for being the best in the U.S. It may be contentious, but I believe that's the best because I'm from here. But how suitable is the New York City water for sake brewing?
So New York City water, known for good pizza and bagel. It's a very soft water, one of the softest in the United States. And if you're a sake geek, you know the sake region called the Nada, famous for dry, powerful sake, and then they have a good hard water. Well, Japan average, the typical water in Japan is a little bit softer side. And then there's a soft water region in Japan known for beautiful sake, like Hiroshima. You know, they have a really soft, you know, or sweet, or delicate sake, thanks to the soft water. And New York water is similar to that kind of water. So New York sake tends to be softer than, you know, softer and sweeter than drier and powerful. And then I like that. The fermentation is slow, or soft water does not have a lot of minerals, which is a nutrient to the yeast to ferment. So the fermentation tends to be slow and gradual, but that helps to have a very delicate flavor at the end of the fermentation.
Right. Well, that makes sense. And it's, the delicateness is the advantage of having soft water, which probably don't make it too alcoholic. And, that's why you also get, I heard you don't dilute, right? Because you had a perfect level of alcohol thanks to the slow fermentation. Right. All right. So let's talk about sake that you produce. So what types of sake do you have?
So right now at our small production brewery, we make three different types: Junmai, Nigori, and Nama. So Junmai is the most basic sake, filtered clear sake with fruity floral aromas, yet,
So the Junmai, for listeners who aren't familiar with sake, Junmai means a pure rice with no added alcohol. And Nigori is unfiltered, and Nama is unpasteurized. So you just talked about Junmai, right?
Yes. Yeah. So Junmai is kind of one of the probably the most basic one out of those three. And then Nigori is a hazy one with coarsely filtered. So it has a little bit of a sweetness from the fermented rice sediment. Mm-hmm. And then Nama is raw or unpasteurized. So it still holds the original brightness and, loud burst of the flavors. So kind of, interesting combination of the three different varieties.
Right. And also what's great about your sake is that the rice is milled down to 60% of the grain. So that means the category is ginjo sake, right? Well, that's ginjo is milled down to 60%, and then it's high floor. The above ginjo is daiginjo, but the more you mill down, the more it gets delicate, and as a result, it's expensive because you kind of waste outside. Although the outer side of the rice milled down, I used to for feed or something. But but the point being, it's ginjo. So you have Junmai Ginjo and Ginjo Nigori and Ginjo Nama.
That is correct. Well, I didn't want to confuse my customers with throwing too many technical terms. I decided, let's put just one word. It's simpler. And if I have to pick either Junmai or Ginjo, my sake tend to have more character of Junmai than Ginjo, thanks to Cal Rose. So I decided to use the word Junmai.
Right. Okay. So how do you call the style of sake?
So I'd say it's fairly, basic or simple. So, my Junmai sake is like a textbook Junmai sake type of thing. Nothing fancy, nothing, flashy. Maybe this is my philosophy, but if you're new to beer, you don't want to try sour black IPA with lactose first, but you want to familiarize yourself with IPA first, right? There's so many things. And right now in the US, my typical customers are relatively new to sake. So instead of, throwing a lot of variables in it, I just want to give them an option to learn that, hey, this is a simple, basic junmai sake. It's different from probably the sake that you had before, but this is a craft sake called junmai. Oh, by the way, this is a sake type called nigori, and it's simple, a little bit different from junmai, and those are the differences. Which one do you like? Right. Mm. So at this stage, I'd like to go with a very basic of sake. Well, you know, I love to experiment a lot of weird stuff. So eventually I'll start making like a sour black IPA with lactose and a sake or something like that. But before going there, I need to finalize and then I need to have a solid base of the basic sake.
Right. So based on authentic style and then with local ingredients.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And my impression was your sake is very clean and lots of flavors with balanced acidity. That was pretty impressive to have good acidity. And so I have a tasting note. So your junmai had a very classic rice aroma, followed by crisp acidity and subtle sweetness, finished with pleasant bitterness in my throat. And your nigori is not too cloudy. It's not like, you know, like yogurt cloudy. And it's lightly cloudy and not cloying, which makes it food friendly. That was what I thought. And I mean, this unpasteurized namasake, which I think is an advantage for you to be a sake producer in this country, because to ship long distance, you have to pasteurize sake to maintain that freshness and, you know, not get contaminated. So here in Brooklyn, you make amazing classic style namazake. So it was very bright and lively. And yeah, that's what you look for in namazake. So I was very happy with your products.
Thank you very much. So, you're very good at describing my sake. So maybe I should have you at the tap room and then you can sell our bottles.
Okay. All right. I'll take that. So, so what kind of food would you suggest to pair with your sake?
So apart from the typical, you know, Japanese cuisine, like, you know, you have a Momo sushi shack next door and then they have a great sushi. So, you know, my sake works very well with this type of food. But apart from that, I'd normally pair my junmai with a classic margherita pizza from Roberta's. And nigori, thanks to its sweetness and a little bit of mouth coating of the rice, it works very good with the heat or like a spicy, but a chili spicy food. So, you know, there's a lot of great Mexican restaurants nearby, so I probably have like a taco al pastor or something like that with nigori.
Right.
And then, yeah, nama is bright, so it kind of stands out against the loud food. So, like your the Roberta's stinky, little stinky pizza with garlic, onion. Or, like, there's a food truck in front of the station, the lamb over rice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of spicy food goes very well with nama. That's my typical selection.
Right. Okay, I have to remember that and try. Once everything's open, and then I'll go back and get, I don't know, maybe the nigori. I should try that with the spicy one.
Yeah,
that's interesting, because it's really still, unfortunately, Japanese food and sake. And sake with Japanese food. There's the formula. It's not broken so easily.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like the idea. So there are many challenges in brewing sake in the U.S., but what do you think is the advantage of being outside Japan as a sake brewer?
It's ironic to say this, but license. So although I, you know, complained about the licensing process here in the U.S., it's way much better than in Japan. In Japan, it's practically impossible to get a new license.
Oh.
So nobody can open a new brewery, new sake brewery in Japan.
Interesting. Well, because the number of sake breweries are declining, because I thought they're willing to encourage people to open more sake breweries.
I think they tried to protect that industry.
Huh. But by doing so, they are killing the industry in a way.
Yeah. So I had an interesting story recently that there's a new sake brewery opening in France. They wanted to open a brewery in Japan, Tokyo, but they were not able to get the license. So they decided to open a brewery in France to export to Japan.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's something I'm going to ask about to the Japanese government. So if we find out something, I will do another episode on that.
Yeah.
Right. So what is your mission of Kato Sake Works? In other words, what would you like to communicate to your customers through your sake?
I think, you know, so my typical customer is seller, right? You have not had a good sake before, or maybe you had a sake before, but that was not like, oh, I really love sake. And what I want to tell is sake is a good thing if you know, if you have the access to the good sake. And, you know, so please give us a second try, second chance, and drink good sake. And that might change your, you know, future drinking life. But this is my mission, to make that type of sake available, accessible to the people on the street in Bushwick. So that's my mission.
Right. Yeah, that's very great, because sometimes I'm surprised by myself, pairing sake with non-Japanese food sometimes are way better than pairing with wine or something. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's not just for being Japanese, trying to promote sake, but I think as a person who's interested in eating good food with the maximized value of eat and drink, I think it's important to educate people, let people know how sake can be flexibly applicable to any kind of food. So
I believe.
Right. So you have a very cute mini tasting room with three seats. It was such a nice design space. So what's your plan for the tasting room operation when our lives go back to normal?
when life goes back to normal. I think when life goes back to normal and then everybody starts going out, maybe I should open my tap room 24/7 for like a week so that everybody can celebrate. Right.
Right. Well, actually, I heard that today that the Governor Cuomo, his recovery proposal for the economy really emphasizes on, you know, tourism, including restaurants and bars, you know, encouraged to be open and thrive. Mm-hmm. So that worked after 9/11. So I think it's a good idea. All right. So what's your plan for distribution of your sake?
So we have a small production volume. So we'll start rolling out to the local liquor store and the restaurants. We had some initial conversation before this happened. So we have to go back. The same is true with the tap room. But we start from the local, and then once, you know, that's ready in Bushwick, we go to the next level. So that's how we are planning to do that.
Okay, we'll see what happens then.
Yep.
And the sake market is growing rapidly outside Japan, and I heard in 2019, the U.S. was the biggest importer of Japanese sake, both in quantity and value. And the sake market grows in the U.S., the number of sake breweries is increasing domestically. So I heard it's about 20 breweries in this country to make craft sake. So how do you predict the future of sake breweries in the U.S. and in other countries outside of Japan?
I don't know. I'm not good at predicting the future, but my hope is to have, you know, every single major cities have their own local sake breweries. And if it's a big city like New York, two or three or more. And so that people has more access to the local sake, craft sake, so that they have more, you know, moment to learn that, oh, sake is very good. It's not like, you know, the loving alcohol type of thing, but it's a craft drink. So that's a moment that I hope that everybody in the U.S. can, or, you know, outside of Japan can experience.
Right. I really hope so, too. So, all right. So we're running out of time. So where can we find your updates online and social media?
Okay, so we mostly like Instagram and Facebook. Kato Sake Works is our username. And also we have some information on website. We have a local pickup order, and we are working on the delivery or shipment in the New York. So that's what we are hoping to announce sometime soon.
Okay, and then they can find it on your website, katosakeworks.com. Yes. It's K-A-T-O-S-A-K-E, works, katosakeworks.com. All right, so good luck, and I look forward to seeing you at the sake brewery when everything's over in terms of Corona. So thank you so much for joining us today, Shinobu.
Thank you very much, Akiko-san.
So, see you soon. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akiko@am.com. Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. I'm Genius Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week, and stay safe in good spirits. Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.